This podcast is brought to you by Berry Brothers, sponsors of Great Conversation.
Welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman, the assistant editor, and this week we'll be discussing Boris Johnson's Brexit pitch, the politics of Eurovision, and confessing to our guilty displeasures. First up, Boris. The former mayor of London came for lunch at the Spectator this week. And he has also kick-started his battle bus tour of Britain, which he hopes will convince Brits to vote out of the EU. But before he hit the road, here's what he had to say to Spectator readers.
It's now or never. It's what do you really see as a long-term future for Britain, O Spectator reader? Do you see it as a open, global, free-trading, dynamic economy based on confidence in British institutions, tried and tested British institutions? Or do you believe that we, in order to survive, we need to remain embedded in something that fundamentally takes away our powers to decide what we want to do, and over the last 15 years or so has been a powerful depressor of jobs and growth in our historic European home?
Well, I'm joined now by James Forsyth, who interviewed Boris this week. So, James, what sort of mood was Boris in when you interviewed him?
Very relaxed mood. It was the first weekday when he wasn't Mayor of London. He was joking that he had enough time now to knock out a leader, you know, proof some pages for us. I think he also, though, knows that he's in the fight of his political life. He knows that the stakes for him in this referendum campaign are very high. Because Boris leads by a country mile on every test of who would you most like to have a drink with, who do you think is most fun, and all those kind of things. What he needs to show in this referendum campaign, but on a real matter of substance, he can persuade voters to trust his judgment.
And do you think he is doing that?
I think he's always, I think Boris has always been a slow starter in campaigns. If you look back at this point in his 2008 mayoral campaign or his 2012 mayoral campaign, everyone was saying, oh, it's not working. I think he is finding his range in this campaign, that he is getting there with his arguments. He is clear about what he wants. I was very struck by when we talked about the single market. He said the single market is the problem, not the solution. He was very emphatic, but he didn't want Britain to be in that post-Brexit. I also think that he made a good argument as to why he had changed his mind. He said, look, I've changed my mind, but the European Union has changed too, and it's changed more than me. I also thought it was quite striking how, and I think this is going to be quite an interesting point for the unity of the Tory party after the referendum, when he basically said, look, if David Cameron had got what David Cameron had talked about at Bloomberg, I wouldn't be on the side that I'm on now. And it's the fact that he basically says, I think his phrase is, not one bean, not one sausage, not one jot of a Bloomberg agenda has been delivered. By aiming his fire at the failure of the renegotiation, he is making this quite personal between him and the Prime Minister.
So he's saying it's David Cameron's fault that he's backed Brexit.
Yeah, because his basic argument is, what's the alternative? We've tried negotiating, got nowhere. What else are you going to do?
He was much more personal about George Osborne in the interview, saying, I'm delighted to hear that he's principled. That is a major, major development. Do you think that the two of them have an irreparably damaged relationship now?
I think that things are, that the two of them are now on a very competitive track. That, you know, when George Osborne said on Sunday that the Tory party needed sober, serious, principled leadership, everyone just imagined that that was a shot at Boris, and because it was intended as a shot at Boris, it was designed as that. I was equally, I think, very struck by Boris's willingness to debate David Cameron. You know, he basically says, look, I will debate David Cameron, and then he kept using all these phrases, saying that he would be a wimp if he wouldn't debate David Cameron. He would be a bit wet if he wouldn't debate David Cameron. The clear implication is David Cameron is being a wimp and is being a bit wet in not debating Boris Johnson.
How do you think David Cameron will respond to that?
I think Number 10 are absolutely determined to avoid a kind of blue-on-blue debate, but I think they're equally determined to avoid any high-profile debate, in that they know that they are ahead in this campaign, and they don't want anything that is going to capture the public's imagination that you might see lots of people tune in for and could go wrong. I mean, remember in the Scottish referendum campaign, one of the things that gave the independence campaign late momentum was how, when after a very bad performance in the first debate, Alex Salmond won the second debate against Alistair Darling, and suddenly the Yes campaign had the momentum going into the final stretch of that campaign.
So they've learnt a lot of lessons from the Scottish campaign. Do you think Boris talks about Linton Crosby in your interview, do you think Boris is trying to take a leaf out of the Linton Crosby playbook at all, or is that all David Cameron who's doing that now in this campaign?
Well, I think that David Cameron, they aren't, Linton Crosby has decided to sit out this EU referendum, you know, but it's very interesting that Boris Johnson didn't deny that Linton had made the case for Brexit to him. I think David Cameron's aim is to run a rerun of your general election campaign, which is basically economic competence, and basically it's either chaos or it's me, and you know, stick with Nurse for fear of something worse, essentially.
And in terms of Boris's future, in terms of what will happen to him after the referendum, if there is a Remain vote, we're all expecting him to be in the cabinet. Do you think he is?
I think he is less bothered about that than you might think. He's not pulling his punches at the moment. You know, he's not going as far as some on the Leave campaign would like him to go in terms of being prepared to attack Cameron and Osborne.
So some people would like him to be much more vicious.
I mean, there is a frustration, I think, on the Leave side, but lots of the Tory politicians won't go as far as they would like them to go in terms of criticising.
Do you think they should go further, or do you think it's wise that those politicians are saying, hang on, hold off?
You know, the Leave campaign only have to think about the referendum. These guys have to think about putting back together the Tory party afterwards. But I was quite struck by what he said. If he does become leader after a Remain vote, and he said, look, if we vote to stay in, the next Tory manifesto should admit that we can't do anything to control EU immigration, that pass has been sold. And I mean, that's quite interesting about the change in politics after the referendum, whether politicians are going to start being franker about what frankly is a European Union competence and that Westminster can't do anything about it.
So aside from the reluctance from Boris and other senior politicians to attack their own side in this referendum campaign, that there's also a need for them to convince voters of the need for Brexit and of Brexit being safe, which he talks about in the interview. Boris is clearly worried about voters being nervous about the risks of leaving.
I think he is worried about the difficulty of persuading people to change, because people think that change is radical and that it has to pass a higher burden of proof than the status quo. I thought one of the arguments we'll hear a lot more from the Leave campaign that Boris makes is, look, there is no status quo on the ballot paper in this referendum. If you vote to stay in, the European Union is changing. Just think of how much it's changed from the institution that Britain joined in 1973. It's going to change more with more countries joining, more integration, if we stay in. I think that one of the things that will determine the result of this referendum campaign is whether they can persuade voters of that, that there isn't, you know, that you can't vote for the status quo.
And do you think Boris thinks that his side is going to win?
I don't think he's certain that they're going to win, but I think he thinks they've got a chance. And I think he is finding his range. The best bit of the interview was when he said, look, we're asking people to be brave, to be confident, to believe in Britain. I think he's beginning to find his rhetoric and his language for the campaign. But, you know, look, he has had a slow start to the referendum campaign, partly because he was still Mayor of London, partly because he's had the odd misstep or two. But I mean, the challenge to him now, and you've seen him on tour today in Cornwall, is can he take that energy, that ability to interest the public and use that to convert people to his cause?
Next up, is this the sound of a Russian invasion? That was Russia's entry for Eurovision 2016, an annual clash of music, politics and culture. Or at least that's how Spectator editor Fraser Nelson sees it. He joins me now with Rob Lyon from Spiked magazine. So Fraser, those who tune in on Saturday night are going to see a long line of musical acts ranging from the okay to the excruciatingly bad, and not very many that you're going to remember the next morning. Where's the politics in that?
Well, I mean, you can tell the politics of countries through their culture to a large extent. Not the high culture, not the classical music. That's exactly the same in pretty much every country in Europe. If you want to find out the differences, then look at the popular music, the pop culture. That's what we see in its glorious dimensions in Eurovision night. Each country is coming up with a very clever act. They're putting on a face, their face. First of all, they've got to work out what do they want to say to the world, a world audience. Now, many of these countries are quite small, but don't really get the world's attention. And when they do, often it's for the wrong reasons. If you're Israel, for example, you want to put in an avant-garde act like Dana International, a transsexual, who showed a very different side to Israel. If you're Armenia, you can do a song about the genocide, to put the Armenian genocide, not really musically jolly, but at least you can make a point. So sure, a lot of the countries will just be in to put in a good song to win, but a lot of the others will be making a political point or trying to articulate the historical moment. Now, when that's done, it can be incredibly effective. For example, the second favourites to win this year is Ukraine. Now, Ukraine's got a song called 1944 about Stalin's deportation of the people in Ukraine. So they're making a protest song against Putin, sure, but they're also coming up with something that's very effective musically, very heartfelt. So it's looking as if it might be able to combine a political coup de coeur with the kind of musical theatre that you need. And those two together make a great Eurovision song.
Rob, do you agree that countries are trying to send a message about their identity in their Eurovision entries? I have to say, whenever I've seen Eurovision, it's left me with the impression that Britain's unbelievably naff based on its entry.
Yes, I think that there's a couple of things going on here. Yes, of course they're making it. I mean, it's the national broadcasters who are just deciding these songs. So of course,
oh no, it's the population. They vote for them in most cases.
But the songs that they're choosing from are from national broadcasters, and sometimes the national broadcasters who just jump in and say, "We've decided to replace the song you voted for with something else."
Well, not very often, but anyway.
But I think that the first thing they're trying to do is actually present a good song, and so very often you'll find that, you know, quite small countries will be hiring songwriters from Stockholm and whatever, you know, the people who are writing the hits for everybody else across Europe to write songs to enter for their national contest. So they wanted to present themselves as modern and outgoing. And they're obviously, as you said, with Ukraine, there are these political elements to it as well. To some extent, I think a little bit of the cultural essence has been lost because everybody now sings in English pretty much. And so a little bit of the kind of quirkiness of Eurovision has been lost in that. But still, I think you're right. The Eurovision reflects, you know, Europe as it is in the 21st century right now, and for all its little quirks. So one of the other things that comes up, which is very dark, is songs about kind of typical vulnerability issues. You get songs about child abuse occasionally, or like last year's winner was basically inspired by bullying at school.
Doesn't sound very fun.
Well, I mean, if they cover it up with a good tune, it's fine. But yeah, sometimes they're dirges. So that you get all the kind of things that are going on in Europe, in our culture, in our societies, and whatever, are reflected in some way or other through Eurovision.
So you think Eurovision has a lot of cultural value?
I think it's not high culture, as Fraser said. It's entertainment.
It's low culture, but is more cultural as a result. I mean, look at so much classical music. You go to, you know, any city in the world, you want to go to listen to the opera. You're going to find songs written, you know, generations ago by people who are hanging out in Italy or Germany. What does that tell you about a country or a contemporary society? Absolutely nothing. And even as you say, Rob, there is a tendency to speak more in English. I mean, take the French, for example. For the first time ever, they're coming up with a song which is half in English this year. But that itself is a sign of the way that Europe is going. For ages, the French thought, they longed to think, that France would be the diplomatic language of Europe. There was a time when if the aristocracy in Russia would speak French to themselves, because French was seen as being so cool. But this has changed completely. So, for example, Eurovision doesn't say nil point anymore. Nobody talks in French at all. That's been dropped. French is losing its grip as a language in Brussels. And now even the French are having to adopt to English as a result. They're now expected to be in the top five. So that itself is cultural and political, and it tells you about the increasing dominance of English as a language which people who don't speak English use to communicate to each other. If a German wants to talk to a Czech, they'll speak in English.
But to take it to a slightly more basic level, Rob, is the music actually any good?
I think it's as much of a mixed bag as you would expect in the charts. So there are those kind of songwriting factories that are producing songs for other countries. They sound exactly the same as everybody else's songs that you've heard on the charts. They're okay. Occasionally you'll get some absolute stinkers.
What's the worst one?
Oh, well, there's so many to choose from. This year, the most entertainingly bad one was, unfortunately you won't see it on Saturday, was the San Marino entry, which was kind of Leonard Cohen in it singing Barry White with a group of dancers that were out of Blake 7 or something. It was very, very odd anyways.
If it's derivative, it loses. But even the excruciatingly bad ones can actually give you something culturally interesting to say. I mean, when they fail, it's the way that they fail, which is interesting. And also, I can't think of a bad Eurovision winner for many years. I mean, let's take, for example, let's take Conchita's Rise, Austria's winner a couple of years ago. Now, I can't think, I don't know, Rob, if you can, of another pop song that opened with a minor major seventh chord. It's a luscious sound, which you would not hear outside of a Bond script. To have the audacity to come up with that as a pop song, and it was played a storm. It was an incredibly romantic song. Everybody's attention was taken up by the fact that the Austrians had got this cross-dresser with a dress and a beard. And it was seen as being a kind of, you know, a vote for liberalism. But it wasn't. It was just good music. What annoys me as a Brit is that, I mean, Rob's right, the Scandinavians have got pretty much monopolised the hits on this, because they have worked out now how to come up with songs for Europe, songs that will cross all these cultural and linguistic barriers. But Britain can do this. We are one of the few countries in Europe, apart from Sweden, that actually exports pop music. We could win every single year if we only chose to properly play, and we don't. You know, there are two ways to find out what's happening in European politics. One is to follow all of the debates in Parliament. The other is to tune in on Eurovision night and watch the voting.
And finally, we've all got guilty pleasures, but what about our guilty displeasures? Mark Mason, in his Spectator piece this week, writes about the things we're supposed to like but just can't. For Mark, the things he cannot admit to not enjoying are strawberries, Ella Fitzgerald, and lying on the beach. He also says that the 90s sitcom Friends is another topic which it just isn't acceptable to admit to disliking. So why do we feel obliged to pretend to like things we actually hate? Mark Mason joins me now.
So Mark, why do we find it so hard to admit that we don't like certain things?
I think it's just the pressure of numbers, usually. If 99% like something, for instance, strawberries, one of my guilty displeasures is strawberries. And it seems that, you know, on a bad day, it feels like I'm the only person in the world that doesn't like strawberries. And they're always given out. You go around to someone's for dinner, and, you know, they're brought out as a dessert. And you point out, actually, I don't really like them. You know, when they're underripe, they're like bullets. Once they've gone overripe, they're a very inexpensive way of dyeing your clothes red. And for the 17 minutes in between, that, you know, they taste of not very much, really. But I know, as people are listening to this, they're no doubt going, God, the man's mad. Everybody loves strawberries. If he doesn't like strawberries, there's something mad with him. So that's the problem. I think we now need to have just the courage to admit when we don't feel the same as everybody else does about a particular thing.
This is a fear of other people and of being different to other people, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think that starts in childhood. You know, that's there as, I mean, that's a basic human trait, isn't it? You know, the desire to be with people who are like you and the fear of people who are different. And I remember when I was very young, Vimto, which is still, you know, my 7-year-old son loves Vimto sweets now. I don't think he's ever actually had the drink, but Vimto is still seen as this great king of soft drinks. And I remember when I was about 10, I told our milkman that I didn't like it. And the look on his face, he just couldn't believe it. You know, he said, that's one of my best sellers. And he wasn't angry about it. But I think after that, he looked at me, you know, differently.
So you were conditioned from an early age. And I suppose it works the other way in terms of admitting things that we do like that other people don't. So I remember as a teenager, I was very into gardening. And admitting this to my friends at school provoked absolutely derision from them. But now they're in their 30s. They're all coming to me for gardening advice because everyone else gardens as well.
Well, that's it. I mean, that's how I got the idea for the piece. It's because that's a guilty pleasure. And knitting's a similar one, you know, and it applies to... It originally came about with Sean Rowley, who was... is the guy, if you want to know what his back looks like, have a look at the cover of What's the Story, Morning Glory by Oasis, the guy walking down Berwick Street Market in Soho on the album cover. That's him. And a few years later, he was a DJ and he had a radio show where he played quite a naff. I forget which record it was, but it was one of those naff 70s records. And the switchboard went mad. Everybody loved it. And he christened it the guilty pleasure. So that's the way around that, you know, when you do like something that's supposed to be naff. But it struck me that we find it hard to do it the other way around. You know, to give one of my musical examples, it's Ella Fitzgerald. I just can't stand the woman. So, I find it quite hard to admit it, but I've made myself do it in the piece. And I think the time has come when we all name things everyone else likes and we don't. I tested it on a few friends. Someone admitted to not liking chocolate. Someone admitting to not liking Star Wars. And someone said they didn't like sex. I'm not sure how serious they were on that one.
Hopefully no one you knew very well.
There's any number of corny one-liners I could do to that, but I'm going to rise above it.
Are there any in particular that you find most difficult to admit to disliking, that you think actually that the social reaction to disliking this national treasure or motherhood and apple pie is just so great that I'll go along with pretending that it's wonderful?
Well, yes, a couple of examples. One that I used to be like that with, and then I'm not anymore, champagne. Because actually I did a piece for Spectator Life about that a couple of years ago, about this just arrogance. If you go any function you go to, it's just champagne's given out and there's no other choices because you're just expected to love it. And most people do. And I wrote that and a few people came up and said, you know, either on social media or, you know, at a party where there was champagne around and they saw me having something else, they said, I'm really glad you wrote that because I don't like champagne either. And it was this real sense of a little, you know, having the courage to come out of like all these great, you know, any minority in history has had to struggle to come out. Admitting that you don't like champagne is, you know, compared to some of the minorities in history that have had a hard time, it's a pretty feeble example. But the other one where I still do find it, I don't find it difficult, but I find it easier just for a quiet life to keep quiet, is Richie Beno. Just about every cricket fan and quite a few non-cricket fans that I know worship the guy, even more now that he's died. But, you know, when he was still alive, he was seen as the absolute doyen of cricket commentators and people just worshipped him. People dressed up as him at test matches with the white jacket on and the hairpiece and the Channel 9 mic. And I just always found him to not have much of a sense of humour and to fancy himself. But I know I'm in I think I'm in a minority of one on that. I've yet to meet anyone else who couldn't stand Richie Beno.
That's all for this week. You can subscribe to this podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. And a reminder that podcast listeners can also enjoy a special subscription rate of 22 issues for £22 by going to spectator.co.uk/22.